For November 16th, 2009, it's the Overthinking It Podcast, episode 72, Tiger, Tiger. Welcome to the Overthinking It Podcast, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. From Los Angeles, which I've been given to understand is in the first world, though I cannot get my toilet to stop overflowing, I am your host, Matthew Rather, here with the usual panel and a special guest. So let's get right into the question. This week, if you had to destroy the world in a natural disaster, a la 2012, Roland Emmerich's 2012, which opened this weekend, how would you do it? Mr. Peter Fenzel.
Hey, I want to let everybody know that I just got a new recycling bin, so there's no longer a pile of root beer cans in my room. They're neatly in a wastebasket.
In your basement suite in Cambridgeport, Central Square in Cambridge.
Yes, my beautiful home that women should not be scared of going to for fear of running into some sort of slovenly horror show that I feel like has been implied in the previous podcast. But anyway, I would say that's easy. A tiger. I would set the fury of nature's greatest predator on all of mankind. In fact, on every living thing on Earth, because who can stop a tiger that can't be stopped by anybody? I want to see a war room with a big radar screen on the wall that has like graphics of like where the tiger has been and like large regions of the world the tiger has wiped out. I want to see like the military hopelessly trying to stop the tiger, not like a giant tiger, mind you, like a tiger, like fierce, like
just
camouflaged.
One.
Yeah, like the tiger always manages to lure the military out into tall grass, and then it just like jumps at the tank from behind and like eats and claws its way into the window and like gets the guys inside, and then works its way through humanity that way. And then I would love to see, I'm going to say Treat Williams running away from the tiger for most of the movie. I feel like that would be a combination of an Oscar, a Pulitzer Prize, and the Caldecott Award all rolled up into one.
And a Peabody for good measure.
Exactly.
Is this your sound like you're describing not a summer blockbuster, but a sci-fi movie of the week?
Well, we would just make it cost $200 million. Is that good enough for you?
Excellent.
World's best Anderson film.
Do we have to title them? What's yours called, Pete?
Well, no. So you'd have to make two of them.
Right.
So you always have to make two of them. There has to be like a Dante's Peak and a volcano. There has to be like an Armageddon and a Deep Impact. So there would be Tiger, and then there would be The Great Cat. and they would both be competing movies. And The Great Cat would be like a sort of semi-serious meditation on human nature set against the backdrop of a single tiger exterminating humanity. And Tiger would be more of a sort of Rock'em Sock'em Boffo hero story about humanity's helpless quest to try to quell the hunger of a single tiger.
Well, more of a Snakes on a Plane kind of story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I think that you could, if you get an all-star cast, you get a little Billy Bob Thornton in there, you know, you get a little bit of Jeremy Irons will do anything for money, right? So maybe you can play the tiger. Jeremy Irons
shame.
Is the tiger.
He's a really good actor.
Yes, he's great. You know why he's great? Because you know he's great because people will pay him money to do anything. It's like, hey, I need a Morlock. Who wants to be a Morlock? It's like, oh, I'm one of the greatest actors of my generation. Okay, you. Awesome. You can be a Morlock. Do I get to wear white makeup and have telepathic powers? Yes, you do.
Like Overthinking It muse Tilda Swinton. Jeremy Irons does a lot of stuff that turns out to be beneath him.
I will say this right now. Overthinking It loves actors who get work. Like that. That for us, because we sympathize with actors, because some of us have performed and perform. If you're an actor and you get work and you make it happen, we respect you in the morning in a way that most of the other blogs will not respect you. So here's to you, Tom Berenger, for getting work all these years. Major League 3, you know what? Pays the bills. Everyone's got a family to feed. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Keith
the family's only like, exactly, exactly. International star Lorenzo Lamas. The list goes on. The list goes on. And he would be in the Tiger movie too. Both
thank
of them,
you.
I think.
Thank you, Peter Fenzel, from his now spick and span basement in the Cambridgeport neighborhood of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Moving on to Park Slope, Brooklyn, it is Mark Lee.
That's me. I don't have anything nearly as high concept as a tiger terrorizing the world.
I learned from one of my classmates that what your Korean name is.
Don't reveal my secret to the world.
Oh, okay.
If you speak that over the podcast, it will cause terrible, terrible apocalypse. You wouldn't want that to happen, would you?
What? No. But how? But if you had to cause terrible apocalypse, how would you do it?
Well, it's kind of been done before, most notably in the South Park episode where the internet goes down. But I want to see you have the $200 million apocalyptic movie treatment is a combination of internet and cell phone outage across the world. And part of me wants to see like complete societal collapse, you know, to kind of highlight how weak and, you know, and unresilient humanity has become. But the reality of the way that would come out is, I think, just life would just slow down dramatically. You know, yep. The pace of life in terms of, you know, your ability to make plans in advance and meet friends versus, you know, texting the day of and that sort of thing. So maybe it'd be like, you know, the most boring apocalyptic movie ever is that people, you know, have tamer nights out and stay home more and talk to their families. And that truly would be the end of the world.
As far as I'm concerned, it would.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark Lee. Now, we have a lexicographic dilemma here, because there are two M's on the podcast, and you'll see, you know, you may agree or disagree with my call on this one. We are going to go to guest podcaster Amanda Marcotte. Amanda, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's no skin off my, you know, nose. I just dialed you on the Skypes.
And once you can figure out how to upload Skype and make it work, it's actually pretty easy.
I know. It's so much better than the real phone. When I signed up for it, I like immediately bought every add-on and package I could. And I can't stand calling people on the phone, but I don't mind making phone calls even to other people's real phone numbers from Skype because I don't have to get up from my computer. So how do you want to destroy the world?
Do zombies count as a natural disaster?
Sure. I mean, it depends. You know, are you of the, like, zombieism is a virus school of zombieism, or are you from a zombieism is an ailment of the soul kind of school?
Virus. I don't necessarily think that making it the subtext of it textual is the best idea when you're talking zombie movies.
Right. Yeah, that would be like trying to butter the butter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which they do in the South, actually. They do that in the South. Sorry.
you're Skyping in from the South, from beautiful Austin, Texas.
Yes.
Where my parents met and married.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Hook 'em horns. Didn't we talk about this last time?
Yeah. It's a good town for romance.
Yeah, right.
Wait. And so, Amanda, Amanda, in your $200 million zombie apocalypse, like, what specifically happens? Like, how does this spool out? Is it similar along the lines of other zombie movies we've seen, or is it something special? What's the special sauce in this one?
That's a good question. I guess I was kind of thinking zombies because, you know, you picture yourself as the hero of your disaster movie, and I've seen enough zombie movies that I think I could swing it. I think I could survive that. I'm not so sure about fire or flood or ice or any other Robert Frost style Earth destruction. But
damn you for taking my answer. Damn you for taking the thunder out of this. I was going to wrap up with.
Oh no! Wait, this is an interesting idea though, because you see yourself as the hero of your own $200 million disaster movie. Pete, do you see yourself as the hero who fights cement humanity?
Pete
tiger?
Already said it's Treat Williams.
Oh, yeah, Treat Williams is the hero. From the substitute
I do not see myself as leading humanity out of the darkness and it's, you know, internetless, cell phoneless age. I see myself more as curled up in the fetal position.
Well, I imagine I'd cast somebody else, but I'm thinking like a screenwriter right now.
Oh, this is another good question for a subsequent podcast. Who would you cast in the movie of yourself? That's more like a never have I ever style question. That's more like a drinking game style question, I guess. I guess we have.
We could have a drinking game. We should have a drinking game podcast. I'm well behind. We should definitely have a podcast.
I'd be happy to discuss that later. But as an Asian American, I don't have a lot of choices. disgruntled. Lack of representation. Disgruntled. Okay, I'm done. Moving on.
Wait, what? Wait, are you saying that you don't like that Jackie Chan is going to play you in your movie, Mark? Is that a problem? Is that a problem?
No, what's the name of the guy? What's the name of the guy in Harold Kumar? John Cho, right?
And that's it. See, that's all we have on the list. That's all my options. And neither
no,
are
no, no,
one. He's on Flash Forward, so.
Oh, he's on Flash yeah. Forward now? George Takei.
No! That's just not even off the table. I have respect for Sakai as a man, an actor, and a swordsman. But no, not he will not. No, he does not portray me.
And a swordsman.
How about Ichiro? It should be Ichiro. Yeah, it's like a special sports movie. He can be like a fights crime with a baseball bat, and then he can be you.
All right. I know we could go for, you know, 5 minutes and list all the Asian American actors we know, because it would only take 5 minutes.
What about the Asian actors? What about like Chow Yun Fat or something? He's badass. He's spicy handed. He's the spicy handed god of cops.
Not to sound racist, but you know, the actor in question would have to speak English. Oh. Well enough to play the banana that I am.
I guess he does not. Because you're yellow on the outside, but you have a creamy white center.
Oh, good Christ. Yeah, come on, people. Come on. Keep it together. Stay on target. Stay on target.
Is that the idea? All right. Amanda's saving the earth from zombies. What is Josh McNeil doing? Oh, this is the problem I was having. Some systems of spelling treat Mick as its own letter. You know, that is separate from, like, if you look at a lot of old-fashioned Rolodexes, they'll have a separate Mick card that is distinct from the M card. I guess because you want the, you know, you want all the mix, like, you want all the dirty, dirty Irish and Scots.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's before Mick Brown versus Mick Board of Education, I think.
So I decided, well, and this is what I said, I decided to be integrationist and, you know, and get Josh into our...
To alphabetize using the standard alphabet.
Right.
Good work.
Rather than a special, you know, ethnically insensitive alphabet of my own devising, because if the Overthinking a podcast is about one thing, it's ethnic sensitivity.
It's true.
Which means it isn't really about anything. Sorry.
How are you to answer your
question, Matt, I've long had on my office wall a quote from Frank Zappa that says, it isn't necessary to imagine the world ending in fire or ice. There are two other possibilities. One is paperwork and the other is nostalgia. So I would actually like to see the $200 million epic in which nostalgia ends the planet.
So yours is a clip show is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's like, remember that time we were fighting the aliens? Yeah. Cuts to Will Smith in like the thing. Man, that was a great time. Oh, man.
I actually see this more like it could really work with any other device. Like, say, for example, there were a tiger slowly killing the world. Shouldn't it? Yeah, but imagine, like, instead of the president, you know, sending drillers to fight the tiger, the world's best deep core driller
to
kill
plant
the tiger.
Nuclear weapons inside the tiger and explode it, which is the only way to defeat the tiger.
Yeah, instead he and like the Senate just sit around and like talk about how much better it was before there was a tiger. And thus the world ends. That's my film.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving right along. I get ready to drink, those of you playing the Overthinking It podcast drinking game, because whenever Rather quotes a long swath of English verse, you have to chug. You can't drink until I'm done with the poem, because if I'm reciting, you damn well better be drinking. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. Though, if I had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. And you're
speaking strange, flowery words I don't understand.
Hey, Pete, Robert Frost is not a modernist because his poems rhyme, right?
Gosh darn it. Matt, you know just what to say to piss me off. If we were in a marriage, there would be spaghetti plates flying around right now. That would not be feasible. No, yeah. I got actually just a little bit of a quick background is that the worst grade I ever got on a paper was on a paper that I wrote about how I considered Robert Robert Frost to be a modernist, even though he wrote formal verse. And I was
He wrote accentual syllabic verse.
And I was given a very bad grade on it because the by a divinity student who wasn't actually an English related faculty member or a graduate student. They just happened to put this person in the TA position for this course, who said that I didn't quote the poetry enough, which led her to think that I perhaps hadn't read it. Which was, I mean, when you're talking about Robert Frost in particular, is kind of insulting because it's like 40 pages long, and like if she understood what I was talking about. But anyway, so the next paper that I did on the wasteland, and all I did was underline all the times that they mentioned water and just list them. And I got an A. And she's like, this reads just like the wasteland. Sometimes I don't know whether I'm reading this or the wasteland. A. So there you go. That's why I get angry when people talk about Robert Frost and formalism and accentual syllabic first.
Favorite college paper would be another another one.
Good question. Mine was called Afrofuturism and Wolfram Dunks Effect, and it was about like staging conventions at Parliament Funkadelic and Earth, Wind & Fire concerts as they related to the work of Bertolt Brecht. I love that paper. That was
mine,
a great paper.
Mine was a tie between a paper I wrote called This Sex That Is Not Own, O-O-N, which is the Middle English word for one, which was about genderist performance in The Wife of Bath's Tale, and is a who wrote This Sex That Is Not One? Lucy Rigoret, French third wave feminist, wrote this thing called this influential paper, or the one where I proffered a deconstructive reading of 1 Corinthians 13. You know, love is patient, love is kind, love endureth all things, and called Derrida to task for being complicit in the religious project that he purportedly seeks to undermine. You know, good stuff. Anyone else want to weigh in?
No, I really don't. I wrote lots of crap during college. I prefer not to relive those awful papers that I wrote. Let's talk about pop culture instead of...
Rather's movie is clearly about the world ending through literary analysis.
2012, McNeil, you're the only person who saw it. 2012, Josh, blatant power grab by the Republican Party.
Clearly. With Sarah Palin's book being released the same weekend as this movie, I think there can be no doubt that the movers and shakers on the right are taking over via the box office and some truly impressive CGI rendering.
But what about the movie? Ba-da-da! No.
It is exactly what you think it is going to be. Things are destroyed, and for those who are less interested in that, John Cusack is, I'm told by the women I saw it with, still very cute.
Oh, that's great.
He's as great as he was in Say Anything.
Actually, we spent a lot of time after the movie talking about how it could technically be a sequel to Say Anything if you imagine Iona Sky could evolve into Amanda Peet. Which frankly works a little bit.
Iona Sky.
I like how that process is evolution. That's like an evolutionary process. It's not like growth or aging. It's like there's some sort of like mutation that takes place.
What happened to Iona Sky? I'm searching IMDb for her right now.
After she gave him a pen, no one was willing to hire her again.
But this, I mean, hasn't this, Josh, you said there were like articles on the Drudge Report that are about the political implications of, oh, okay, so she's been working pretty consistently since Say Anything. So sorry, Iona Sky, we salute you at Overthinking It as one of the actors who works.
Yes. Excellent.
Josh, what's this business about a supposed political subtext or, you know, a political upside for the reactionary forces of, you know, Fox News?
It's a purely fictional correlation that I made up earlier when we were talking. Just Drudge Report. Has on it two different articles that in the title say 2012. One of them is about how the movie did tremendously at the box office. The other one is how, like, Republican hopefuls are already running for president. In 2012. thus those two, in my mind, have become correlated simply by having appeared on the same news conglomeration site.
Isn't that Yeah, I mean, like, isn't it a little early in the cycle to be, I mean, we're 3 years out now.
I think that's standard now.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Now, Amanda, you were saying something earlier before the show started about this idea that people kind of want things to start over, right? It's like things are so bad, it's time to just hit the reset button.
Well, I would imagine that in the studio, that was probably a selling point in their presentation to get this movie greenlit, was just that, you know, A, it was Independence Day on steroids, but also you could sort of say, like, as much as we elected Barack Obama to be hope and change, the flip side of that is just like, let's burn it to the ground and start over. And I think people would pay a lot of money to engage that fantasy. And it looks like they gambled correctly on that. As soon as I saw the ads for it, I was kind of like, yeah, this is really... They couldn't have been making that movie before they knew the economy was going to crash, but it kind of hit at the right time, I think, for that.
Mm. Is it... But, well, yeah. Disaster movies, I mean, what is the attraction... In a more general sense, like, okay, like, I buy the argument that, like, yeah, wouldn't it be nice to just clear the board and start again? But other than that, I mean, beyond that, what's the attraction? I gotta say, I kind of don't get it. Like,
stop and look at car wrecks, Matt. Stuff getting destroyed is inherently cool.
I guess it's
something in our psyche.
I think most American disaster movies are about bad marriages. They're about like relationships that are decaying. No, seriously, think about it. Independence Day. There's like multiple marriages that are like failing or incipient and coming on.
Will Smith and his wife, the president.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum and his wife.
Yeah,
yeah. Twister, as I mentioned, is all about a marriage that's failing. And I think the implication is that the complexity of the world is part of what makes people's marriages fail, because so-and-so has to work, and like so-and-so has to like be worrying about all these things, and we're stressed out, and we don't get to be together the way that we did when we felt like we were the only people in the world.
That's a very structuralist view. Well, yeah, I guess so, because like romantic comedies are all about agency, right? And like I guess disaster movies are all about, you know, forces beyond our control.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, it's almost like I don't want to be held responsible for the way I've screwed up my marriage, so I'm going to like put it in the context of a screw-up that is so phenomenally enormous that it can't possibly be my fault, and therefore like I will for a hot second not be blamed for everything that went wrong.
Star Trek IV is about the relationship between Kirk and Spock and how it's getting repaired.
Is Star Trek IV a disaster movie because they're going to destroy the Earth because of the whales?
Yeah, because the outer space probe is churning up the oceans so that humanity can't live anymore, right?
Without Armageddon is about the estranged relationship between Bruce Willis and his daughter, right? And the idea that he sort of needs to be wiped out and replaced by a younger guy, right? Because he's getting old and he can't connect with her, so he needs to be like supplanted by Ben Affleck as like the man in his daughter's life, and like that's how you restore the sort of cogency of this sort of male female pairing, right? This like which is creepy when you think about it, that like in that movie, like Ben Affleck very much does replace Bruce Willis. It's really along the old paradigm of the daughter leaves the father and is like sent to the family of the husband, and like becomes the same thing that she is with Ben Affleck, that she the same thing with Ben Affleck that she was when she was with Bruce Willis.
I disagree. All, I disagree. Yeah, like
cheap,
I disagree.
Cheap
Armageddon.
Domestic labor, you mean?
Yeah. No, well, I'm just saying drill, baby, drill. What?
You got it all wrong. Armageddon is really about being a vehicle for the Aerosmith power ballad. That's what it means.
You're saying it was the powerful Aerosmith soft rock lobby that put Armageddon together and like raised all that money?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, yeah, that's awesome. What cheesy Aerosmith song we want to do? What's our excuse to get them to market? Let's make it.
I want to see all the meetings they had for like the 20 years before they made Armageddon, like the secret cabal that's trying to put Aerosmith soft rock songs on the radio. Guys, we got to pick our battles.
Yeah, 20 years before. Yeah, the whole thing was a conspiracy to get Aerosmith to record a soft rock song to begin with, right? Because like up to that point, it had been like Living on the Edge, you know.
You know, Loving an Elevator.
Yeah.
You know, like, Dude Looks Like a Lady. They certainly weren't happy with that. Dude can't look like a lady. Dudes have to be dudes and ladies have to be ladies, and they have to sit in bed in their middle age and feel sad about each other, but also look at each other. And like that's what the American Dream is all about. Is basically you look wonderful tonight, like played really slowly while people gaze at each other over a bottle of Merlot. You know, like that's how the world ends. Not with a bang, but with a glass of wine. And so, no, not with a bang. You're not getting a bang because I have a headache. So.
What was that, Amanda?
Oh, so explain how Titanic fits into your theory then.
Well, okay, I'm going to have to cite my friend Raph here, who you guys, most of you guys know, who has one of the most amusing and wonderful stock conversations that he ever has with people when he really wants to piss them off, which is he'll sit down with a woman and he'll insist that the only good guy in all of Titanic, the only person who's trying to do right by everybody, is Billy Zane. And Titanic is the story of a whole bunch of people who are messing with Billy Zane in his attempts to provide a good life for the woman that he loves. And like, oh, she's just cheating on him. And like, oh, you know, like, you know, he tries to save her, but she won't go in the boat because of the guy. You know, I mean, Billy Zane, he gets her this wonderful diamond. He does all these nice things for her. And what does she reward him with? You know, she's a trollop. And like, then, at this point, the woman is sputtering, like actually sputtering, and like her eyes are huge. But no, I mean, Titanic is well, because there are two failed relationships in Titanic, big ones. There's the failed relationship between Rose and Billy Zane. And there's the failed relationship between Rose and whoever came after Jack Dawson, who, despite being married to her for like 150 years, like doesn't even mention, render her a footnote in the story of her life upon the day of her death. So Titanic,
it's about how relationships are only good if they last 3-4 days and then somebody dies.
Perhaps. I think in the case that also Titanic is being told in the moment, right? It's a reflection. It's trying to heal through memory the disappointments of life, right? So she's looking back on her life, which has been fairly unremarkable except for this Titanic episode, and she's trying to achieve a sense of closure and wholeness and satisfaction with the loves of her life, who for like 99.9% of her life have been huge douchebags who presumably don't even, like, you know, she doesn't even remember with fondness at all. I mean, that's an exaggeration. She does say she likes she loves her husband that came after Jack Dawson, but it's hard to really believe her. But much like Twister, much like Independence Day, it's an exercise in healing. It's like an exercise of making peace between men and women who have, like, fought each other, right? Because in the end, yeah, Rose is rebellious, right? Rose wants to fight the expectations. But what does Rose really want? She wants to be with Jack. She wants to be with the hero. She wants to be with, like, the dashing, good-looking guy. I mean, she's kind of hitching it. You know, she's kind of repudiating everything about her character that she stands for, like, up until that point, right? She, like, wants to be away from Billy Zane because she feels like she can't really be who she wants to be. And then what does she do when she gets with Leonardo DiCaprio? She subsumes everything about his identity, everything he wants her to do, everything that he does because of the exoticness of it and the sexual attraction of it. And you don't see anything of her, right, when she's with Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm sorry, that's another one of my rants where I talk and I don't let anybody else talk. But look, I'm just saying, if you don't feel passionate...
We saw plenty of her in that scene where she's being sketched by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yes, the thing that she brings into the relationship are her boobs. Yes.
I guess so. Yeah, that is kind of retrograde as far as sexual politics are concerned.
Look, you can be blasé about a lot of things, but not about Titanic, all right?
That Titanic still has the biggest plot hole probably ever constructed in a giant blockbuster, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Like, remember how the whole narrative was about how she tells them, they ask her where that jewel is, the one that they think is on the ship?
Yeah.
And she's supposedly telling the story to them, so everything on screen is what she says to them. How come they don't figure out that she's got the jewel on her?
You don't frisk her when she goes into the boat.
Well, because she told them the story.
Yeah, why don't they figure out from the story that the jewel was not, in fact, lost? Because we never see the jewel being lost, do we?
Right.
Well,
right,
you
right.
see her looking in her jacket at the end of the movie. So, in theory, she told them that. So they must be the biggest morons on the planet.
Oh, right. That's very interesting, right? That, like, yeah. does the flashback all have the same narrative status, right? At some point, does her memory get away from her and she remembers things that she is not, in fact, narrating? And what happens when that happens? Do they go to sepia or something?
I mean, I don't think they have different levels of presentationalism when they're reflecting on her memories, right? I mean, they do use some sepia, though, sometimes, but it's mostly for transitions and for illustrating the use of paper and of drawing.
That effect when they go from the sunken boat with, you know, moss growing on it and whatnot, and cut from that to... fade from that to the CGI boat that, you know, in its heyday. Like, they couldn't do that enough times for me. I think that was awesome.
Another fun thing about that is that the big romantic theme between Jack and Rose is that, you know, they're never going to let go. But at the point that Rose is telling the story, you know, everybody that she's loved from her own generation is dead. And the movie is all about all the people who have died, right? So she's creating this sort of justification of this idea that the people didn't leave her, right? That the people are still with her, which is very similar to the idea of a disaster movie where because of what happens to the world, we get to forget the bad things that have happened to us in our lives, right? Because of what happens on Independence Day, we get to forget about the 10 years where we didn't get along living in an apartment, right? Because of the fact that, like, we can remember Titanic, you know, we can forget about the fact that, yes, there was a good chunk of time when, like, our marriages were bad. And also we can forget about the fact that you did abandon me. You did let go. But I can recreate it through the ritualistic destruction of the world. It's like the world dies for ransom. You know, it's like the old Matt, you can probably tell me which subset of Christianity this refers to, but the idea that the main purpose of the sacrifice of the Messiah is as a recompense and as a ransom to win back the things that have been lost because of our own mistakes. That the earth dies for our sins. And then in the end we get to hang out with like whatever like actress they choose to cast and
isn't that
and because it is guys
isn't that,
there's
right, never isn't that like every isn't that every branch of Christianity? Like, isn't that the idea?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't want to get into it in a huge amount of detail, but like, it's not always just strictly the idea of it's tit for tat, right? It's not always the idea that you have to like make a payment on an account that's due. Like, there's other paradigms for it, you know, like that it's an act of love, you know, that he needs to like that he has to cross over to the other side because he needs to fight the devil, there's the idea. Oh gosh, what like. The idea that he has to show off the role of traitors, and I don't know. I mean,
the word redeemed, right, and the Greek word that it's a translation of is means bought, right?
Yeah,
like
yep.
Redeemed, like we'd redeemed a coupon, and so when we say that, like when early Christians say that, you know, they were redeemed by this Jesus fellow. They were saying that my soul has been bought. My soul has been purchased by, you know, through the sacrifice of Jesus. So this kind of economic discourse, I think, is not totally off the wall.
And also remember what Leonardo DiCaprio says, right? When Leonardo DiCaprio says in Titanic, let me see if I can get the exact quote. I don't want the message board. But he talks about at the end, how does he describe him getting on Titanic, right? It's like the best thing he ever got, right? He bought the tickets, like he won the tickets. It's like the tickets themselves, the acquisition of them, is the price that's paid, and it's weighed in the balance, and it's found to be like the right price to pay. I don't know. There's something transactional about it.
Relationships. Speaking of something transactional about relationships.
Land it.
The author of the books on which the television series Secret Life of a Secret Diary of a Call Girl is based, the so-called Belle du Jour, has revealed her true identity. Her name is Brooke Magnanti. She is a British research scientist, a PhD biochemist or some such. Who works in a hospital on infectious diseases or something like that, and that the episodes, the 14-month stretch of her life on which the book is based and then the subsequent television series and things like this are based, took place actually while she was earning money as she wrote her PhD. I sympathize as someone who is, you know, dealing with Stafford loans right now in the graduate school. I wish I could get a book deal. Anyway, her name is Brooke Magnanti. She is 34. She is a scientist. That show has been seen in 34 countries. So what is this? I mean, I don't know. What is this? What is this thing? What is the social significance of this? I mean, this strikes me as like, you know, a second wave happy hooker.
Well, before we get into the main text of this, I mean, how popular is the Secret Diary of a Call Girl thing? This is what, a Showtime show?
Yeah, it was a Showtime show. I saw it. It was probably bigger in Britain, where it was, I think, on broadcast television.
Ah, I see.
Channel 4.
Okay, so not really quite the pop culture phenomenon as something as, say, well, the other shows on Showtime, like I don't know, True Blood, or the other, various
California,
other things on
California. On premium, no, Showtime. Cable. Showtime is United States of Tara, Weeds, Californication, Dexter, right? Like, really good shows. No, just, and they were eating HBO's lunch for a little while until True Blood came along and kind of got HBO's mojo back.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me, by the way, that that people have time and money, not just for the basic cable shows and network shows.
Right, which cost $60 or $70 a month anyway.
Yeah, this is a massive market, and that, you know, the shows on HBO and Showtime are still able to hold the a foothold in pop culture, such that we're actually talking about the Secret Diary of a Call Girl thing. But that's my little aside there on paying for TV. But back to the meat of this.
Well, yeah, no, and I'm sure, Mark, that no one does it by going to easytv.it and using their favorite torrent client to get all the television that they can eat.
Certainly not.
Certainly not. That would be illegal, and we are not advocating that. I'm saying absolutely under no circumstances do not.
Yeah,
go to do that. It is too convenient and too easy, and you have to jump through the bizarre, cost expectations and windowing practices of the actual entertainment industry. So what I mean, I don't know. Where do we stand? What are we, Pete, I know you said you were going to lay off after that last thing, but please don't lay off. Like, where do we stand? Where do we stand with this? What do we think of this? Does this matter?
I think it matters. I think it matters that she's a professional. I think it matters that she's intelligent, right? I mean, I don't really know about what sort of I haven't seen the show, so I don't know how she's presented, in the context outside, like what she might be like outside of her being a prostitute. But I think, it makes me think of all the time that people talk about, like, the middle class in political discourse. I was thinking this the other day, X is good for the middle class, X is bad for the middle class. I don't think people have a really solid understanding. Like, people define the middle class negatively a lot of the time as, like, not the problematic people, right? Like not the people who are doing the things that are detrimental, or the people who really need help, or, like, not the people who are involved in a huge crisis. Like, the middle class are the people who have nothing exciting happen to them or are down the middle. They're neither rich nor poor. But the subset of people who have not at all impacted by, like, the shadier things in the world, is vanishingly small. I mean, everybody has some stake in this game, and you think, every prostitute is a runaway, or like every homeless person is a drug addict. And like, I think it shows that the diversity of human experience can integrate in ways that we don't like to think that it can, because we insist upon these preconceived identities, these platonic forms of how we ought to live our lives.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it there, Pete. And I'll cite a specific example of the probably the last prostitute to really make the news. That would be Ashley Dupre,
right?
Elliot Spitzer's call girl, right? I think very much fit that platonic ideal.
Isn't it interesting that we call her Elliot Spitzer's, that we use the possessive when we, Elliot Spitzer was her client.
We could go over the whole thing. The prostitute that serviced Elliot Spitzer.
Well, there you go. You're putting her in a subordinate role again, even though she's the person who's offering the
you know what
service.
You are, Mark? She was an employee. Sexist.
So I guess she was an employee, but she was also she was also a specialist who was called in for her specific skills, in which she was very well trained. She was brought in by the governor of New York to do something that governor could not do himself. How many people would he do? Like, how many, under what circumstances? Elliot Spitzer is the kind of guy who liked to take care of things. He did not pass off. He did not delegate. This is the one time in his career when he said, I can't do this.
I think nature.
Well, no, actually,
now you're throwing the naturalist fallacy at me, that something can't be true, that something nature is dictating what's right or wrong. Good
if
or bad.
We could all take care of that for ourselves, there would be no us.
Fair enough.
But anyway, back
enough.
To this platonic ideal thing here. So, Ashley Dupre, right? I think, from a lower socioeconomic status, for lack of a better word, portrayed by the media as quote unquote trashy, right? you know, people pointed to her MySpace page and, you know, she wanted to be a singer and all these kind of things. Clearly not of the same, you know, spoken of in the same way as we're talking about. What is this, a British research scientist?
Yep.
With a PhD, right?
Yeah.
It's a total polar opposite.
I mean, isn't it interesting that she's always described as a high class call girl, right? Like, so many things, you know, our sexism comes into it, which is like, if anything, more pronounced in Britain. And I know we have a large British listenership. So actually, I'd be really interested to hear how this revelation played in England and in Great Britain and, you know, elsewhere in the Anglophone world. 20 Epilogue 01.
To be fair, wasn't Ashley Dupre also described as a quote-unquote high-class prostitute? I mean, she was expensive, right?
Well, an expensive prostitute, I guess.
Right, so...
Yeah, so...
All right, okay. While I look up Ashley Dupre's hourly rate...
I think we remember, like, wasn't her Facebook page outed, and the prose was not nearly as good as...
No, she was trashier than that. It was a MySpace page.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She's trashy. No, yeah. It's...
I think that's the only significance, and I think Pete nailed it, is that she is not sort of like a desperate, awful person who was doing this because it was her last option. That was clearly not the case. And like, that makes some people uncomfortable. In terms of the actual, like, Matt, you used the term revelation, and the revelation is that this call girl was in fact a call girl.
Like, no, the revelation is of what the real identity was. We had never known. She wrote under a pseudonym, and it was never known.
I realize that, but it's not like it was, you know, like one of the royals. I mean, it was just a person who was like needed money and did like was a hooker to get money, which we guessed like early on in the plot of Secret Diary of a Call Girl.
But it's there was a lot of. I mean, that was the TV show, but it was. When the books came out, there was a lot of speculation as to, like, well, is this a man? Because this seems so, I mean, this seems like such blatant male fantasy, happy hooker stuff. Or is it, you know, or is this some kind of, writer trying to make a point about something? You know, a lot of...
Why do they keep trying to do that? Those stupid writers making points about stuff.
I mean, with an axe to grind, you know, with an axe to grind about sexism or something like that, trying to make a point by inventing and making that point by inventing a character, and it's not a real thing. So the fact that it's a real person, I think, does bear on, you know, was an important revelation. But, you know, you could tell, I guess, from reading the prose. Though I only know the TV show. I've never read the books. But I gather that...
I have two more revelations that come out of this. One is everything I just said could be wrong if you use Occam's razor to instead determine that we must all face the fact that graduate students are among the nation's desperate poor and should be treated as such.
Well, I wanted to bring that up because, like, this is Britain where they have a much better social safety net than we do.
Now, wait, is she a graduate student or is she a researcher? She's a graduate?
Now she is. She was a graduate student during the 14-month stretch during which she was a prostitute to finance her PhD program. Mm. And then she stopped working as a prostitute. And once she had the PhD, began working as a researcher.
I guess the only weird thing is that she wasn't paying her way through college. She was like a level after that, right? But no, I mean, I think it does say that, like, we like this pretension that if you don't make any money, you can still be part of the middle class. I mean, you could say, I don't think it's true, but you could definitely say, like, well, we think of people as being driven to prostitution by poverty. Here's a woman who had all these wonderful skills and she's still driven to prostitution. Yeah, but she's still not making any money because she's being paid like half of minimum wage for her job. Right. And she's not even getting tips. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, the Petri dish doesn't tip you back. I mean, the other realization is that there's one person that I owe a big apology to based on a lot of things I've said on the podcast and based on this. And that person is Denise Richards, because I was expressed incredulity and affront in the portrayal of her nuclear scientist in Tomorrow Never Dies as sort of like a sex object, right?
Christmas Jones.
Yeah, as Christmas Jones. Perhaps the characterization of Christmas Jones is not, in fact, an implausible exploitation, but is, in fact, a window into a way in which different roles for people do intersect in this entirely this complex world where class is not broken down on a stratified level. Maybe Christmas Jones is also a real person, an implausibly sexy physicist who works in Kazakhstan and like sleeps with secret agents. I mean, maybe this is the case. Maybe there are a lot of scientists who wear tank tops and bounce as they run.
Comes more than once a year.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's obviously not the case. But think about that in context, though. Think about how kind of, like, the condescending I get, right? I mean, that's easy to spot. But I think
And you're one of the more sensitive people that I know.
Yeah, but like how sort of like implausible it feels when you see like a female scientist subjecting herself in a movie to like sexual objectification, right? And you're like, oh, that's stupid. And I'm not saying it's justified, but I'm saying that like that dual pressure, you know, is in the world too. Like these things coexist in the same universe. The, you know, when you put on the glasses in real life, you don't necessarily lose your capacity to participate in sexual things, even though you do in the movies. And as much as we criticize that, we also protest against deviations from it, right? Like the smart girl isn't supposed to be the one who's having sex in the movies. Is what it was.
Well, speaking of deviation, I mean, let's be honest here. Let's be realistic about what we're talking about here. You know, this is a deviation. This is an this is a exception to what we think we know to be the norm, right?
I think I have kind of a distinction there between expensive prostitutes and high class prostitutes.
Right.
And I think it's like, if you're high class, it's probably because you made more on the book deal than you did actually as a prostitute. And that's not going to be happening for Ashley Dupree, I'm afraid.
Sarah Palin can write a book, Ashley Dupree.
Yeah, I mean, she can get a good who ghosted Sarah Palin's book?
The Christian editor of some Christian website. Yeah.
I just honestly don't think most people care that much. I think there's exceptions to the rule. You know, Diablo Cody, she was smart enough to know she has one good book in her about being a stripper, but after that you got to write about pregnant teenagers and stuff.
and Megan Fox killing boys. Not people, boys.
Wait, Diablo Cody was a stripper?
You see?
What do you think she was?
Rewind.
A scientist? She can't be a scientist. She would write all that sexy material if she were a scientist. Jeez, where's the narrativization, man?
Come on.
Everything has to make sense in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Mark, bun on phone, bun in oven. That's all I'm going to say.
All right, a couple interesting pieces. I've been reading this other article about this woman.
I was wondering why you were pretty quiet.
Okay, well, so she was studying in the Department of Forensic Pathology, which is sort of, you know, very trendy at the moment. But she's currently studying the effects of pesticides on children. So presumably she's going to get attacked from the right. There's going to be a lot of people coming out and saying, like, this woman did a bad thing. But, like, this money allowed her to get the degrees and the knowledge that's going to allow her to, like, protect children from dangerous pesticides. So I'm just going to throw that out as a preliminary argument for, like grand total from a purely utilitarian perspective. Like, where are we on this?
You're saying that that more graduate students should be prostitutes because it helps finance the research that saves lives.
Well, not like English major graduate students. Graduate students are actually going to help.
You know what? F you.
I think the right thinks that children should be protected from sex more than pesticides, though.
Yeah. Well, it's worse now, for them.
Are we talking
Certainly
about the,
at the
Tories
same
here?
Time.
Are we talking about the Tories here, or are we talking about the elephants?
I think on both sides of the pond, there's a reactionary kind of. They're just grumpier in Britain.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, right? Like, here's the quote from the publisher. We've published her since 2005. We're looking forward to continuing that relationship. And here's the quote from the current employer, University of Bristol. This aspect of her past bears no relevance to her current role at the university. Both of which seem dead on to me, right? And, like, you'd have a lot more hand-wringing from a, UC Berkeley or something. Or, like, a, you know, I don't know, what's like the University of Bristol? Duke or something, right? Hey, like
Oral Roberts.
Well, that
let me bring up an American analog. Maybe you guys remember this person, maybe you don't. Does the name Melanie Martinez mean anything to you?
No.
Okay, Melanie Martinez worked on the kids. She worked on the PBS Kids Sprout Network. She was a host of a show called The Goodnight Show that was for small children. And she was fired from her job, and this was back in 2006, because she had appeared in a hilarious viral video that I know all of you guys – I don't know if you watched it, Amanda, but I know these guys watched it back in college.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Technical Virgin, right? So this is not somebody who is going out and having sex for money. You know, this is somebody who made a funny video about the hypocrisy of born-again Christian kids who have butt sex in order to avoid pregnancy and deflowering, which, of course, as those of us who have grown up in this era of sort of renewed –
butt sex.
Yeah, butt sex. I mean, I know I can't count on both hands the number of people I know who are like of this paradigm, right? It's like an active, real cultural phenomenon, right? The technical version phenomenon. And
really?
She made a funny video.
Okay. What? Yeah. I
mean, you know.
I didn't know that many, like, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe I did in college. Growing up, it seemed like everyone was boinking everybody, but, you know, never.
Well, mind. Yeah, I mean, you know. You
grew up on the decadent West Coast, Matt, rather. Don't forget that. Some of us came from the Bible Belt, where things like acid mattered.
You know, I think it's also, I mean, most of the Christian kids that you were around were like, you know, were Catholics, and it's a different vibe. Yeah. I think they just have the sex. You know, I don't think there was
as much
of a big
deal. I thought Catholics had a reputation as being exceedingly uptight.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I don't want to go down. Actually, making that division is not useful because it just is showing my own prejudices, which are like kind of thousands of years old and a thousand years old and for no reason. Anyway, against schisms. No, no, but I think obviously it's like, well, this was somebody who had direct contact with kids as opposed to somebody who was only studying chemicals that had direct contact with kids. But it's still a situation in which, you know, somebody yeah, somebody who does work now that is beneficial for children and families and does the things that presumably we want people to do with their time and their money, you know, is working for a nonprofit organization that's entertaining and educating. And she is, you know, kicked out of this and her career is tanked because of one sort of piece of comedy that she worked on. She's in like a couple of shots, right? She has like a little monologue, you know, years ago. I mean, I think that perhaps the fact that Diary of a Call Girl is something that a lot of people don't want to talk about in the first place because of its popularity, you know, maybe it's not a battle that they feel like they can win, like they can win this battle against this technical virgin person, but against Melanie Martinez. But I mean, I think it's interesting to see that this is probably going to play out differently than it has in the past, but that doesn't mean that it had to play out this way. Right, like we're not in Leibniz's sexiest of all possible worlds, where like we know the way that these situations are going to play out ahead of time. Like it could go either way for any of these people. I mean, there is definitely the capacity to lash out at these things. So,
speaking of someone good for children and families whose career is in a shambles, no, okay, let's try this. Let's try this again. Speaking of the perils of abstinence-only education, does that work? Yes. I don't know. Whatever.
Speaking of apocalyptic 2012.
Oh, dear God. You betcha. Sarah Palin's book is what is coming out this week, right? Found that now, and we all recall the story, the weird bit of political theater, right, where it was supposed in the press that that Sarah Palin's baby that has Down syndrome was actually Bristol Palin, her daughter's baby. And the response from the Palin camp was, no, that is not the case. It is not Bristol's baby because Bristol is, in fact, pregnant. And, you know, so anyway, so new revelations about this. Quote to Barbara Walters, that's why I was so shocked, Palin tells Barbara Walters in a new interview. Truthfully, we were devastated. She talks about, and I guess she's doing the other interviews she's doing, or I guess the Walters interview is being syndicated to a bunch of places. So there you go. To air Tuesday morning on Good Morning America, the book's being released. Okay, that's the background. Sarah Palin going rogue. Hey, Amanda, tell us about going rouge.
The Nation has put together a book of essays from it, and it's kind of funny because it has a similar title and a similar cover, and it's just a bunch of liberal writers writing about the Sarah Palin phenomenon, and I was a contributor, and I kind of examine different ways that if she decides to run for president, she's going to go down, because that seems inevitable to me. And felt like at the end of the day, I think I'd like it if Levi Johnston was her downfall. That would be the funniest.
Because he's posing for Playgirl, right? That's the boy that boinked her daughter.
Are you serious? He's posing for Playgirl? Jeez.
And he said he's going full frontal. This is a family show, so I'm not going to say any more about that.
We try to go 15. Yeah, no, Levi's.
So we're going to see. We're going to see the drill baby drill. Is the drill baby drill? If you want to see his baby drill drill, go to Playgirl. Check it out.
I have a specific question, actually, about the title, Going Rouge. Is that a reference basically to a politician that wears makeup and that, you know, her being one of the most prominent female politicians in a long time? Or a reference to red, like red state? Or, I mean, obviously it's a good play on going rogue, but was there anything else beyond that?
I think it was just a joke about her kind of very feminine, cutesy appearance. But, you know, I don't know. I didn't actually ask the editor about that.
I like.
I think she'll be most offended by the fact that you went French with it.
That was probably part of it, actually, knowing the editor of The Nation.
I feel like the books are both most attractive as a product that I would want to buy when they're next to each other, because like they're the covers are in parallel, right? It's like the same cover, the same font, but like one is sort of like bright and sunny and cheerful, and one is sort of like chaotic and evil and frantic. It reminds me of Nelly's Sweatsuit album, where you have like the one where he's like during the day and he's hanging out and sweat, and then there's a one where he's like, it's time for him to party, and he's like dressed up in his suit. You know, it's like a McDLT. You know, it like comes in two parts, and they go great together. I want to see a package deal where people can buy both books at the same time. Can we make that? I guess we can't make that happen.
If you buy either book, make sure you use the affiliate link to Amazon. Because it costs a zillion dollars to host these freaking podcasts for you people.
I mean, I liked the picture that I made of Jack Bauer wearing makeup when he was going rouge. I don't think I saw that Photoshop, but it's in my Jack Bauer in the Age of Obama post about like his frustrations with the world as it is, and all his like pictures of him screaming.
Copy that.
Yeah. Wow. You know. So is it? I don't know. Is it the whole this whole connection between Sarah Palin and third parties? Is this like? I mean, the whole moose connection. I can't get away from. Is this some sort of like moose conspiracy? You know, because we got the bull moose, right? Like we're reenacting the story of the bull moose party, right? Which is the early 20th century. Seriously, we're talking about when Teddy Roosevelt wanted to be the Republican candidate for president, and they wouldn't do the things that he wanted them to do. He started a third party that he claimed the mantle of his kind of not conservatism, but like, you know, the stick-to-itiveness and the elbow grease and all that stuff that was the sort of narrative of the Republican Party of the day, and made a moose party. And of course, what did the moose party do but fuck it up for everybody? Screw it up for everybody and get Woodrow Wilson elected president. Which, I mean, I have no problem with that, except for the whole, you know, Jim Crowing of DC and all that, but I mean Woodrow Wilson is all fine and dandy. But like, yeah, what is it with American third parties emerging from the Republican Party to create self-destructive political dynamics and moose? Are they behind it? Is that the plot?
was there a Ross Perot moose?
Well, there
I guess
was General.
He was big eared, and in that sense, he was like a moose with antlers sticking out of his.
Yeah.
Head.
Exactly.
The moose must be a powerful animal to lure both somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, educated, intelligent, and Sarah Palin in.
Both interested in shooting things. Roosevelt, it was Cubans. But
yes, Sarah Palin wants to shoot wolves from a helicopter. Teddy Roosevelt would cream himself at the notion of a helicopter and wants to shoot. Man, I would love to see like a time traveling show where Sarah Palin and Teddy Roosevelt hang out with each other. I feel like that would be really fun to watch. I don't know exactly how it would play out. But I feel like it would be pretty amazing. Like there's a time traveler who accidentally assassinates John McCain with like the same bullet that at the same time assassinates McKinley, and there's like a temporal rift, and both Teddy Roosevelt and Sarah Palin become president at the same time, and then like then they have to fight crime. I think this would be a great movie.
Show the time movie.
Show the time movie. Call Lorenzo Lamas.
Does that count as a national?
What were you saying?
Everyone behave. Amanda, you go.
I was just going to say, does that count as a natural disaster?
Zing! That's what we in the business call a callback. And that callback is probably a good enough place as any to leave the show for the week. So, do you want to go rogue? Do you want to be a rogue commenter? I'm especially interested in hearing from Brits who want to talk about how the Belle du Jour revelation happened across the pond. Is that something that people still say across the pond? I do.
Amanda said it earlier in this podcast.
Oh, it shows you how much I listen. No, I remember it. But I mean, we're all, you know, effete liberal intellectual snobs, right?
Lattes. Speak for yourself. I am not an intellectual. I'm a travesty.
Latte swilling, Volvo driving, you know, snobs, right?
Yeah.
My other car is a bicycle.
From the fake America.
What are you getting at? What's your point?
My point is, I still
live in Texas.
Good point. Home of barbecue. My point is, do they say that in the real America? Do they realize that there's a pond in the real America? Are you from the real America? Do you want to send us hate mail? We'd love to get it. You should leave a comment on the show notes. Use the contact form on the site. Email podcast@overthinkingit.com or give us a call at 20, and I mean this, Republicans, eat log. 01. That's 203-285-6401. Thanks to the panel. Thanks to special guest Amanda Marcotte. I hope we have you back, before too long to do this again. I'm so hoping that you and the podcast will have a third date.
Awesome.
And as always, until that third date, you and all the listeners should visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, the site that subjects the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.
This summer, the cat killed curiosity. This summer, stripes are slimming. Wait, no. This summer, meow.
Directed by Oliver Stone.